Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani Alba. We are very excited this morning to have a guest with us who is near and dear both to Christopher and I, and of course, to University of Helsinki's Global Development Studies program. We will be jumping over to the Latin American context. I am definitely not the most exciting part of the conversation today. So without further ado, I would like to turn the floor over to our wonderful guest. Would you like to tell us who you are and what you do?
Yes. Hello, everybody. Very nice to be here talking with you, Chris and Sophia. My name is Eija Ranta. I am a university lecturer of global development studies at the University of Helsinki in Finland. And I am currently on a 5-year research leave as an Academy of Finland research fellow in the same discipline, global development studies. I am leading here 2 research projects. Both investigate diverse forms of societal activism in the global south. One is on citizenship utopias, where together with Henri Onodera and Martta Kaskinen, we examine indigenous peoples' activism, youth activism, and feminism. And then I have another project on anti-racism activism in revolutionary contexts. So working currently mostly on research, but of course also teaching and conducting all kinds of societal activism myself here in Finland, mostly related to development cooperation issues.
Thank you so much, Eija, and welcome. It's so great to have you here. So I guess to start out for our listeners, how did you get here? I mean, how did you get into global development studies? And I mean, I know a bit of a spoiler alert, but we know that you've done a lot of work around Bolivia. So yeah, how did you get here?
Oh, wow. That is a good question. Actually, I come from countryside, from Finnish Lapland, which is not maybe the most traditional place where you come from when you end up working in this kind of field. And also not a typical route to come to the University of Helsinki. I think in global development studies, what fascinates me most is the search of global justice and the evening of drastic global inequalities that exist at so many levels, economically, politically, socially, and also conceptualizing what development means and how in different parts of the world people conceptualized social change and what is good life for them. I think that has been something that has motivated me, and also, of course, ways of perceiving life from such angles that are important to people themselves in diverse kinds of contexts. And I don't know if something to do with my own background in the peripheral area of Finland in the countryside. Of course, I've been reflecting quite a lot of that on how it affects my ways of looking at inequalities and regional, geographical, economic inequalities. And currently, my focus on societal activism also, it has to do with the larger aim of thinking how everybody on this earth could live a good and decent life with the climate and environmental challenges and political and economic challenges in which we are currently living.
Thank you so much for that explanation. And there certainly are a lot of challenges facing the world. As Christopher mentioned, you are working a lot in the Bolivian context, and I heard you use the phrase a good life. Could you tell us a bit about the research that you've done in Bolivia and a little bit about what living a good life means in that context?
Certainly, I can tell you a little bit about Buen Vivir thinking, or how in Bolivia they try to talk of Vivir Bien, which means basically living well. or living in plenitude or living in harmony. I have been investigating this term during my doctoral dissertation, which I defended in 2014. So that is already some time ago. Currently, my own research related to Bolivia focuses more on the aftermaths of that kind of alternative development thinking, but maybe I talk a little bit about that later on. But about some 20 years ago, I did some volunteering in an indigenous organization in the town of Cochabamba in Bolivia, in an organization led by Quechua indigenous peoples. And through that organization, I had possibility to live in various Andean communities, Quechua and Aymara communities. And basically, the political struggle that the organization was living in was raising political consciousness for indigenous peoples, better political representation and kind of a political change that would start from indigenous peoples themselves, from their own movements. And in that organization, the concept of sumak kausai was really important. It is Quechua concept that references living well, that was later translated into this vivir bien notion, which is a Spanish notion for living well or good life. And that vivir bien became Bolivia's state policy since 2006, when through major popular indigenous working class student uprising, new kinds of people came into political power. And it was quite well symbolized through the presidency of Evo Morales, who is often portrayed as Bolivia's first president of indigenous origin. And after that change, there was a lot of discussion about state transformation and decolonization of the Bolivian state and constructing a plurinational state on the basis of indigenous people's principles and indigenous people's quest for self-determination. So vivir bien is basically a concept that comes from indigenous people's struggles to build a different kind of society based on their own principles. One of the main ideas was that you can't separate people and nature, that human and more than humans are interconnected, and there is a need to rethink this kind of division between people and nature, and rather think of individuals, communities, and nature as a joint living environment. And basically, the idea of vivir bien somehow symbolized this conviviality. And maybe what is also important is that as state policy, its principal idea was to think development differently. And it also was portrayed as a major criticism of the concept of development as economic growth or modernization.
Thank you so much. I mean, these are such huge concepts and such a shift as well, I mean, in views. And I mean, you kind of hinted at it before, but I think something that's coming to people's minds is, so what has happened? I mean, of course, you mentioned Evo Morales, and you know, for people who are watching international news, as I imagine many of our listeners have, you know, in the past few years, there was, of course, the whole issue of him possibly being voted out and going to exile, and then like the seemingly far right wing coming in. So how has this played out? I mean, I know this is a very big question, but you know, it's we're all eager to hear the next part of the story.
I was also, and that's why I'm in this project on citizenship utopias. Our idea with this research project was exactly that there has been during the last decade or so this kind of really major popular uprisings in different parts of the world. We know the Arab Spring. We know the rise of indigenous peoples in different parts of Latin America. And so many expectations and hopes were projected to these major popular uprisings. So what is it that happened afterwards? In Bolivia, there has been many changes, for example, in terms of what kinds of peoples are in the parliament. There is absolutely more indigenous representation, more representation of peasants and popular groups. There's also more women, for example, in the parliament than earlier. There was governments such as Bolivian governments, but also in Ecuador, Venezuela, and so forth. Some of these left-wing governments were able to also to make major changes to extractivist industries, increasing state control and increasing state royalties. Constitution was redrafted in Bolivia. And for example, this concept of vivir bien and the idea of plurinationalism is now mentioned in the constitution. So there are changes. However, many contradictions and tensions also rose. Maybe I could first mention this tension and continuous contradiction that exists in Bolivia in relation to extractivism. Vivir bien ideals promote harmony with nature. They promote rights of the Mother Earth and rights of indigenous peoples. In practice, however, a very strong emphasis on state-led extractivism of such natural resources as oil and natural gas has been put forward by the progressive left-wing government. There has been many tensions between government and a small minority indigenous groups, particularly in the fragile and ecological biodiversity hotspots of Amazonian region. And some of these conflicts have been very violent, and indigenous people's rights to their lands and territories have been severely repressed. Furthermore, Evo Morales' government put a lot of energy in securing Morales' own presidency. In those elections where conflicts rose a few years ago and Morales in the end went into exile, it was already Morales' fourth time when he was trying to become a president. The new Bolivian constitution allows only two consecutive periods. So there were concerns about democracy, concerns about centralizing power to Morales' political party, MAS, which is Movimiento al Socialismo, towards socialism political party, which has majority at the parliament. It also leads the executive. And it has a very high presence also in the media, at the legislation, and so forth. In terms of indigenous organizations, as many indigenous representatives became ministers, they became parliamentarians, with time there also became this concern that what happens to autonomous indigenous organizing? Have indigenous organizations been so closely integrated to state institutions that there no longer exists a critical indigenous societal force that would also hold the government accountable for what it does. And this was particularly of concern during diverse kinds of extractive conflicts that have increased over the years. And so at some point it felt like certain peasant groups or indigenous groups are put against other indigenous groups, and like this concern of whether the government has sort of co-opted most autonomous organizations to its own ranks. And if those ranks start to become very centralized, then where is Indigenous people's self-determination and Indigenous people's autonomy to decide about themselves, to decide about their lands and territories through their own cultural and political institutions that are also recognized in all international Indigenous peoples' conventions? So this is one of the key concerns that have existed in Bolivia, I would say, since 2011.
Thank you for that. It's one of those things of our field. I want to say it's an interesting situation, but also a sad situation. You know, thinking of, even remembering the sort of hope around, you know, the first indigenous leader of Bolivia, all these changes, all the discussions, and then seeing this sort of slide towards, as some call neo-extractivism, and this clash with indigenous groups. But I was wondering, for our listeners especially, what are some of these clashes? I mean, would you mind digging into some of this? I know I've read a bit here and there about expansions of extractivism into Amazonia, as you had mentioned, but some more specific regions, which I believe there had been promises that would never happen, and then it did, which then led to these resistance movements, very, very strong resistance movements. Would you mind unpacking a bit of that for us?
Yes, I could tell you something about the so-called Tipnis conflict. Tipnis is an indigenous territory and national park of Isiboro Secure in the Bolivian Amazonas, between the region of Cochabamba and the Amazonian region of Beni. So it is a region that connects the Andean Mountains and the Amazonian forests. There has been a conflict in Tipnis since approximately 2011. Tipnis is a home to Yurakare, Mohenyo, and Chimane indigenous peoples. It is also a place where increasing amounts of coca growers live in small peasant communities. In Bolivia, since already 1960s, there has been a so-called colonization program where poorer peasants from the Andean Mountains have been supported in their moving to the Amazonas to cultivate land there. And particularly in the 1980s, 1990s, coca production increased tremendously. That was when neoliberal reforms privatized many of Bolivia's mines, and a lot of those former miners who got sacked from the state-led mining companies, they moved to the Amazonas to cultivate coca. And that is also where Evo Morales' political background is, he was and is still a coca growers union leader. And when Evo Morales came to political power quite early on, initiatives arose for building a road to this region of where there are both these coca growers and there are indigenous territories where at least three different indigenous peoples groups live through their own traditional customs and political and cultural systems. In addition to enhancing market access to coca, the aim of building this road in this protected park has been to facilitate oil exploration and natural gas exploration. Contracts have been made with Venezuelan, Brazilian, and French companies, for example, that support the Bolivian state-led oil company to start exploring oil from this region. So basically, most indigenous groups in this region, they have, of course, resisted government's road building plans and extractivist development policies very fiercely because they fear deforestation, destruction of their environment, and of course, end to their ancient ways of living together with forests, with the rivers, with the different species that exist in their traditional neighborhoods. However, most of the coca growers and their peasant unions have been supporting government's development plans, and conflict between these two groups have been very violent. And the state, the police, and at point there were also military involved. They have been violently repressing indigenous people's marches against these government's extractivist plans. But the curious thing here is that most of those peasants who live in the region and cultivate coca, they are Quechuas and Aymaras, so of indigenous origin as well. However, they have changed their traditional lifestyles into more kind of agrarian peasant kind of lifestyles. And through the cultivation of coca, of course, they are very closely connected with capitalist markets. And there are very deep conflicts between two ways of living. And however, we can, of course, say that also these coca growers come from poor families, poor households. So in terms of income generation, of course, their concerns are legitimate from that perspective. An interesting thing is that Evo Morales' government was very strongly against U.S. imperialism and also this kind of European colonialism and private corporations, multinational corporations that increasingly expanded to, for example, to the Amazonas during the 1990s, were very fiercely resisted. However, then when in government the opinions have changed, it's just that now it's not private multinational corporations entering the Amazonas and violating indigenous people's rights to self-determination and autonomy, but it's rather state-led companies and the government's own policies and government's own approaches in which they collaborate with new development actors such as Brazil, China, India, Russia, Venezuela. So same kinds of policies, but different kinds of actors.
That sounds like such a frustrating situation for the people of the country. There have been all these promises that then really don't come to fruition. So where do people go from here? What happens in light of this type of bait and switch?
Well, it is important to remember that in the country, different people have different interests. And actually, still today, the MAS government, which currently is not led by Evo Morales, but President Arce, there's still a lot of support for the government. Due to international high prices for hydrocarbons and minerals, actually Bolivia's economy boomed for many years. And when, as the state got more royalties from extractivist activities, it was channeled to diverse kinds of social protection mechanisms. And due to that, in general, there has been a reduction of poverty in Bolivia and rise of many popular groups and working class people to middle classes. So there is still a lot of support for the government. However, the question is, what is the status of a small minority indigenous peoples who pay the price of these extractivist industries? It might be that majority of the poorer people, for example, in the cities, they may benefit from many of the new social services that are financed through royalties from extractivism. But the prices are paid by small indigenous groups, for example, in the Amazonas. And the biggest question for the future is how to balance between these two issues, how to balance between the need to reduce poverty in a lower middle income country, as is Bolivia, and how still to recognize and value indigenous people's rights to live their lives in their own lands and territories through their own cultural, political, and economic systems. The problem in Bolivia is that many issues in terms of redistribution come from extractivism. They don't come through other institutionalized mechanisms such as taxation. And for example, richer people pay very little. There's no kind of like progressive taxation, for example, that could otherwise institutionally construct these welfare systems that are now built on the basis of these royalties from extractivism. So in terms of democracy and in terms of indigenous people's self-determination, what is absolutely necessary is that indigenous peoples regain their autonomy and regain their voice through societal activism, and that they can hold government accountable for what it does, what it says, what it promises, and what it does in practice. And then in terms of poverty reduction and redistribution of resources, some more institutional mechanisms should be considered. But of course, we know that that is really difficult in a global system where most global South countries still depend very highly on exports of minerals and other natural resources.
Thank you so much for that. And I mean, you're touching on so many different things that I know we would love to dive into. There's so many angles here. But we also know that you have a lot on your plate today, and you were very kind to take the time to talk with us. But of course, we don't want to step on your time too much. So at the end of every episode, there's something that we like to do.
Are we going to do it like today?
Indeed, we're not doing it tomorrow.
So right now, this is going to happen right now.
At this very instant. It's time for...
The
so
question?
Question. Question time.
Question time.
So at the end of every episode, we like to ask our guests the question. It is a sort of call to action for our listeners. They're hearing this conversation. Their interest is piqued. They want to be able to do something in their daily lives. So what can you recommend for our listeners as something they can do in relation to this fascinating topic?
Oh, what a wonderful question. I was actually thinking about something else, but now immediately, because Finland is currently living in a very crucial moment when the government is changing and there's far-right government has entered. So actually, the first thing that comes to my mind is that we have to remember to vote. That such an easy thing to do, that we have to vote for those who care for human rights, who care for democracy, who care for the environment, who are concerned about climate emergency, who are concerned about immigration, who are concerned about issues related to development. But the other thing that I was thinking is, this has nothing to do with the academic world as such, but during the last few years, I have been reading a lot about my own country, about Finland, about Lapland, the region where I come from. And although I've been always interested in Latin America, Africa, in global injustices, I have actually realized how important it is to also know about your own past, situate yourself, and through reflexively thinking about your own path, it may enable you to better think about concrete mechanisms on how to push for changes in epistemic global injustices, which is really crucial in such field as global development studies. So know your past and know also the history of your own country and know where you come from and situate it within the very complex global big picture, and through that aim at evening epistemic injustices globally.
Thank you so much for such a compelling answer to the question. And what a good reminder to our listeners that to understand what's going on, quote, out there, we also have to understand what's going on at home. So thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed getting this insight into the research that you do in Bolivia and a very beginning of the lay of the land there. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you so much. And, you know, we definitely have to have you back on in the future. I feel like, you know, we're just starting to touch on some really interesting points. I mean, even your answer to the question, I'm like, I feel like we could have a whole podcast episode dedicated to that. And so we'd love to have you back on, especially as your project is developing, hear more about your insights into these citizen utopias. And yeah, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you so much, Sophia, and thank you so much, Chris. It was really nice to be here.
Thank you so much once again to Eya Ranta for taking us on that fascinating journey, looking at citizenship utopias and the challenges that they face. Please join us again next month for another fascinating dive into the world of extractivisms and alternatives. This episode coming to you from three different continents and the southern, northern, eastern, and western hemispheres. I am Christopher Chagnon on behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.